My name's Tim, and together with my wife Lulu, we're planting a church, which is actually the story of KXC. If you haven't been before, KXC started 8 years ago. And the story of KXC is basically the expansive story of the church. It's always growing, always extending, and amazingly, and we feel so privileged to be able to do this. My wife and I are part of that story by being around as part of the team at KXC, and then this year starting a new church. And so we're doing that in East London. And if you live in East London or interested in church planting, we'd love to talk and to meet with you. It's a real privilege and we're having a fun time. So if you were here last week, there were three amazing different messages through the day, but I want to pick up on something that was actually preached about 2 weeks ago. If you were here, Pete James was doing an incredible job at looking at the parable of the mustard seed. And he wanted to tackle this idea that the formation of who we are as people often happens unintentionally. By effectively, he stole this diagram from someone, which apparently is okay. You can do that if you're a preacher. This diagram that talks about the way in which we're formed and we become as human beings, saying that the stories we believe, the habits we practice, and the people we surround ourselves with, they ultimately affect us in a way that's so powerful that it's almost unintentional. They just form us once we've decided the habits, the people, and the stories we believe. We're formed by that environment. And when he was talking, he wanted to tackle one particular story, which is, I can only contribute if I'm impressive. And the heart of his message was that idolizing the impressive means that we discount ourselves. And there's one element that he talked about that I just want to go a little bit deeper into, and that's how comparison stops us. Comparison keeps us still and stuck. I don't know what you see when you look in the mirror, when you see your own face. I wonder if you hold your gaze and what thoughts come to mind. I wonder if they're positive or negative. I wonder if actually maybe for some of us it's really painful to look at ourselves in the mirror. When you've got a problem with comparison, you don't see your own face, you see somebody else's. You've effectively put someone else's face, somebody else in the center of what it means to be you, and you can no longer see yourself clearly. Comparison cripples the church, and at times in my life it's crippled me. Comparison feels like when you look at someone, maybe standing up here behind a microphone, and you think, I'll never be like them. I'll never be a good enough Christian. Or maybe when you're sat next to someone and you feel ultimately crippled because you think, I'll never be as good as they are. I'll never be as thin as they are, as clever as they are. I'll never be able to do what they do. I wonder if you've ever actually, occasionally like I have, found yourself criticizing someone when they're successful. You look at them and you think, well, you only got that because... You only got that promotion because you were. You only got that boyfriend because you're whatever. Like we look at people and we criticize them. That's what it is to compare when somebody else is in the mirror. And the thing is, we only get two choices when we compare from a negative place. And both choices are destructive. The first is we feel superior. And the other is that we feel inferior. But tonight, I think Jesus wants to encounter you and he wants to bring freedom. If you, like many of us, have found ourselves looking not at your own face but somebody else's, you've taken the hands off your life. Tonight, Jesus wants to remind you who you are and whose you are. He wants to speak to you and bring freedom to your life. If comparison cripples this church, then Jesus wants to bring this church alive by speaking freedom to you. I want to start by talking about Peter, one of Jesus' disciples, because actually comparison has been around for a really long time. And Peter, some of you would know, he was one of Jesus' disciples. He was a fisherman. And Jesus said, Peter, drop your nets, real nets, like that you catch fish with. Drop your nets and become a fisher of men. And I don't think Peter understood what that meant. I don't really understand what it meant, but he did it. And that's the kind of guy Peter is. He just does stuff. Really kind of obviously, sometimes stupid things. And like brash things. He's bold. So Peter's the kind of guy who when Jesus was being arrested, he got out a sword and cut a guy's ear off. I mean, that is a weird response, right? Particularly if you're considering that if you're going to go through the effort of getting your sword out, you might as well like stab, but cutting someone's ear off, that is just wonky. And so he does all these like bold and brash things. So when Jesus sort of gives everyone a sneak peek that he's actually God at the transfiguration, there's clouds and flashing lights and dazzling robes, it says, and Moses and Elijah appear. Peter, who often takes over responsibility for situations, decides that hospitality is down to him. So he looks at the situation, and the only rational thing he can think to say is like, should we put up a tent? I mean, what a strange thing to do. And he's the one that when Jesus was walking on water, he says, Peter, come and walk with me. A miraculous thing. And Peter's like, well, I'll do it. So he gets out. I'm not going to, I think, well, maybe, no, I won't. But he just goes, I'm going to do it. And if I was like walking on water, I'd just feel like I'm nailing it. I'd do a handstand or something. But Peter, who's already done the difficult bit, then freaks out and sinks. And although it's like, that's just sort of true to Peter's story, he's bold, he's brash, and then gets things wrong. He also knows Jesus so intimately, because actually we missed that in that moment. It says Jesus put his hand into water, picked up Peter, and the two of them walked back to shore together. And through all of this, Jesus loved him. He's the one that first said, when Jesus said, who do you say I am? Peter said, you're the Christ, you're the one that's going to liberate. Jesus then actually said what the Christ was like, what the true Christ was like, that he would suffer and die. And Peter actually took him to one side and gave Jesus some coaching on what it is to be the Messiah. He sort of said, that's not a very good Messiah, someone who dies. And then Jesus had to, in fact, Jesus' harshest words are to Peter, because he's kind of like the problem disciple. So Jesus has to really kind of like rebuke him numerous times. But we get this picture of a bold and a passionate man who gets things wrong. And this picture behind me is by Caravaggio. And I saw this a couple of years ago, actually last year, in the art museum in New York, and it just really like hit me, the power of this image, because it comes from one of two defining moments in Peter's life. This is the moment after Jesus has been arrested, and Peter, who swore that he would never deny Jesus, is being asked by this soldier and this woman, do you know Jesus? And he denies. He denies, in fact, three times. And they're there in this courtyard with a coal fire burning in the early hours, just as dawn is happening, because there's a cock about to crow. Peter denies Jesus. And then Jesus dies, and for Peter, who kind of couldn't quite get his head around the whole dying thing, was expecting Jesus to come on a horse with a sword, not on a donkey, to die. Peter just couldn't really deal with this situation, so he does what came natural to him. He goes back and he becomes a fisherman again with his friends. He goes back to Galilee, and they're fishing, and then one day, a strange man appears on a boat and gives them commands, and they kind of like probably freaked out because it was Jesus and they could hear his voice and they start doing the things he's saying. And then it's John who says, it's the Lord. And Peter, who's always bold, just basically falls out the boat. The moment John says that, says he got out the boat, I kind of imagine him like just like tripping over and sort of splashing, sort of falling, comes towards Jesus. And he can't believe it. Like, how can this be? Jesus who died is alive. And then Jesus says, let's have breakfast. And then let's pick up the story in John 21:15. When they had finished eating, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? Yes, Lord, he said, you know that I love you. Jesus said, feed my lambs. Again, Jesus said, Simon, son of John, do you love me? He answered, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. Jesus said, take care of my sheep. The third time he said to him, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Peter was hurt because Jesus asked him the third time, do you love me? He said, Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. Jesus said, feed my sheep. Now, unpacking these words fully is for a different sermon, but the point is clear that Jesus wants to encounter Peter in the heart of his pain. This is the second defining and most defining moment of Peter's life, when for the three times that Peter denied Jesus, Jesus forgives and speaks purpose and destiny. That this is a man that he had previously promised the church would be built upon. He would be a pastor, a carer of sheep, the sheep being the people. And at that moment of profound and beautiful love and reinstatement, we then read this. Very truly I tell you, this is Jesus speaking to Peter, when you were younger, you dressed yourself and went where you wanted. But when you were old, you will stretch out your hands and someone else will dress you and lead you where you do not want to go. Jesus said this to indicate the kind of death by which Peter would glorify God. Then he said to him, follow me. Peter turned and saw the disciple whom Jesus loved, that's John who wrote this, following them. This was the one who had leaned back against Jesus at the supper and had said, "Lord, who is going to betray you?" When Peter saw him, he asked, "Lord, what about him?" Jesus answered, "If I want him to remain alive until I return, what is that to you? You must follow me." So for this scene, you basically got to imagine mood music and a soft focus. And the credits are just below the screen, just waiting to happen. And Peter has been forgiven, reinstated, divine purpose and destiny is spoken. And all that's left to do is a great big soppy cuddle, Peter to like blub on Jesus' shoulder, and then the credits come up, the music lifts, it's the end, it's a great climax. But actually, it's very different. Peter's there, talking to Jesus like this, hearing this great, you know, "Do you love me? I love you. Feed my sheep, feed my sheep." It's just the most beautiful, profound moment. Couldn't be more meaningful. Three times on the beach, there's the cold. "Oh, that's just like when I betrayed you. It's the morning, just like then. You're entering back into the heart of my pain. Me and you, Jesus. Me and you, Jesus." And then he sees John starting to walk by. And he's like, "Yes, Jesus. Yep. Yeah. Feed my, yep. Yep. What about him?" I mean, what a ridiculous thing. What a ridiculous thing, but what an encouraging thing. What an encouraging thing. At the heart and the foundation of the church, there's fragile hearts like yours and mine. Fragile hearts like Peter, that even face to face with Jesus, feel this crippling sense of, what about them? But Jesus responds. He responds, "What is it to you that you must follow me?" Right in that moment, Jesus still doesn't give up because he always loved him. Through the ups and the downs of Peter, through his boldness and his mistakes, Jesus still loves him. And the call is the same for Peter: follow me. And it's the same for you and I tonight. If we feel stuck and crippled by comparison, Jesus wants to encounter you in the place where there is pain, and to call you forward to follow him. We're left really in this passage with a problem. "Lord, what about him?" And an answer: "What is that to you? You must follow him." Let's start with the problem, and then it gets better, so don't worry. But we'll start with the problem. The whole problem of comparison, it's been around in the scripture since the beginning. It's been around in humanity since the very start. We read of Adam and Eve, who weren't ashamed to be naked. Not crippled by comparison, but in KXC speak, they're in the nod, running around in the garden, having a lovely time. And then sin. And sin, described by 16th century writer Martin Luther, is a life curved in on itself. The reducing of what was a life is meant for a relationship with God and with others, but it's a reducing of a life until it's like Peter's hands. If you see in this picture, Peter's hands curved in. What, me? No, I don't know him. I don't know this man. Well, sin curves us in to the point where there's only us. We're made for a relationship, but actually we start to just almost obsess about who we are at a place that robs any perspective. It's an individual without relationship. Sin is selfishness. And that's the heart of comparison, that fear of the other, that fear that our friends might be threats to us, that fear that God is actually not good, the fear that we've got to look after ourselves. That's the heart of sin. That's the heart of comparison. It's been around since the beginning. And we live in times that make this a particularly damaging and powerful reality. There's this philosopher, Alain de Botton, who wrote a book in 2004 called Status Anxiety. And the idea of the book is it's mapping out the 20th century as a time of profound social change and profound social mobility. Whereas before, if your father was a butcher, you would be a butcher. If your father was a farmer, you'd be a farmer. And if you were a woman, you'd probably, the expectation and the normal things, you would be a wife and you'd be a mother. And that was what you would do. But in the 20th century, there's such profound social liberation in many ways in race, and but particularly in gender, that suddenly there was new horizons. And the expectation was that actually you can choose a different way and your life can change. You can be born in one position and end in a different position. And as the 20th century went on, landed to where we are now, where the actual assumption is that your life will have a number of journeys and pathways and it's not mapped out. And in fact, we're at a point now where we live in a world, many of us live in London, where decisions are abundant. Abundant to the point that we don't actually feel free. We don't know what to do. I wonder if I asked us, do we know what we want to do with our life? I'm not sure all of us would be clear on the answer. And if I ask you, do you feel crippled by that decision? I imagine that would be true for a number of us, where this expectation that we are to design our own lives according to a standard that we don't feel necessarily we can live up to, that's crippling us. That's keeping us stuck. So we live in a time of profound anxiety about our status. De Botton says that anxiety is the handmaiden of contemporary ambition. We aim for the stars, but we are accompanied by anxiety all the way. I read this book about a contemporary shepherd. A shepherd, they exist. And this guy is in Yorkshire. He's called James Rebanks. He wrote this book, The Shepherd's Life. And he writes about this beautiful book. He writes about his life. And I think his identity, I would call it, it's a thick identity. He doesn't wake up and feel the anxiety of who he should be and what he should do, because he's a shepherd. And his priorities are mapped out. And he has a tradition of what it is to be a shepherd that's handed down to him. He feels incredibly free in that. In fact, he left being a shepherd and hated life not being a shepherd. He has a thick identity. So many of us, are because of this profound sense of choice that we have veneers and thin identities. We pick up our roles and our options like masks, and we can slip between one thing and another, and we feel a sense of thinness about who we are. The beautiful simplicity that I think Jesus offers us is to live our lives fully as they've been given, not to compare, not to contrast in a way that would cripple us. And I want to challenge you tonight to consider, do you want to be free from comparison that cripples you? You see, the curse of the reference group, as De Botton talks about it, is that we find ourselves most unfavorably comparing ourselves to others with those that are like us. I'll explain this idea to you really simply. Could you put your hand up right now if you find yourself regularly feeling thoughts of jealousy towards the Queen? No one. There was one person at the 4:30, actually, which was a little concerning. But anyway, I don't imagine you do you? I don't imagine you wake up and think, I wish I had a bunch of corgis. I would love to be in Buckingham Palace, because it doesn't seem plausible, does it? But if, and I don't want you to raise your hand at all for this, but I wonder if I ask the same question, do you find yourself occasionally or maybe even regularly feeling jealous towards someone else in this church? It's probably a different answer. Because we compare to those that are similar to us. We compare to our peers. And KXC, that's why for this church particularly, this is an important issue. Because you probably noticed there aren't a lot of people that are much older than you or younger than you in this room. And so we find ourselves stuck looking to our peers, stuck looking to one another, thinking that person's, you know, they're like me, they're just a little bit better. They're a little bit cleverer, a little bit richer, a little bit better connected. They've got more options, more experience. They're thinner, they're brighter, whatever it is. We find ourselves comparing ourselves to our peers. And that's why this is an important issue, because it kills the church. We retreat in on ourselves. We step away from who we are and what we bring. And in doing so, we step away from what we can bring and bring out of others. And we have a reduced church. And of course, this is made 1,000 times worse in this digital age. I read the stat that we touch our phones 2,617 times a day, apparently. Just, if you actually think about it, how many times you just actually touch your phone. And that stat was 4 years ago, I just found out. And it was taken from a pool of 100,000 people. It's a reliable stat. So I wonder if you think that's got worse or better. The reality is our phones become mirrors in our hands. And what we see on it, our social media feeds, is killing us. We compare ourselves to this unbelievably ridiculous reality No one really looks like that. So we delegate our identity to someone else's Photoshop skills. It's ridiculous. No one is having that good a brunch. I can guarantee it. And I'm there eating my toast, just looking at it. And like, I'm longing for it, but no brunch is that good, surely. So we live in this like ridiculous, ridiculous world full of like endless sunsets and explosions of avocados everywhere. It's a ridiculous reality. It doesn't exist. One writer calls it a fragile utopia. But yet it's a mirror to us. We don't see ourselves clearly, but we see who we think we should be. And we feel either totally inferior, that we'll never be good enough, or totally superior. We slam them, we criticize what we see, we find the other offensive and problematic because we don't really want to look at ourselves. It's easier to criticize than to actually have to face your own failings. It's easier to feel inferior than actually to face the way you are, in fact, powerful. You are, in fact, beautiful. You have actually been given dignity and grace with gifts. iPhones are delivery systems for comparison. And what we put in the mirror really counts. It's what we'll live for. It's what forms us. And it feels like this. It's like, you know, we know this, obviously, but only we can live our lives, right? And imagine a stage like this. And when you're stuck in comparison, when you're crippled by comparison, you put someone else on the stage and you're left in the audience, either slamming them or fearing them. But the sad thing is they don't really exist because there's only you can live your life. You can't blame somebody else. You can't be cruel. Only you can do it. And we're left at the end just in the audience of our own lives, having not played the part that God would want us to play. And many of us, and I definitely find this to be the case, it's not comparing with other people. It's comparing with myself, who I think I should be. An idealized version of who I've received that I need to be. And I think I need to be exceptional sometimes. I think I can only really be me if I'm the best. I want to be a lion, the king of the jungle. Or I compare myself to a worm and I can't bear just to be me. And I think I'm awful. I'm the worst. I'm rubbish. Actually, you know, Jesus calls us sheep. It's ordinary sheep. But he loves us extravagantly. And that was the heart of Pete's message, if you hear a couple of weeks ago. Ordinary things in the hands of an extraordinary God. Mustard seed in the hands of a farmer. Yeast in the hands of a cook. And a stick in the hand of Moses. Ordinary things. Ordinary things used by God in extraordinary ways. We're sheep. You're not a lion. You're not a worm. You're a sheep. You know you've got a problem with comparison if you can't celebrate the success of others. If you're stingy with compliments, if you can't take a compliment, if you feel that your body disqualifies you from the life God's called you to. To compliment someone or commend somebody else feels like it takes something away from you. And sadly, you know, this is the case even sometimes in my own heart. You secretly look at someone's success and you wish for them to fail. Because them succeeding somehow threatens you. And so the outcome of comparison, by the way, do you remember when I said it gets better? Don't worry, it does get better. But the outcome of comparison is these internal emotions run riot in our lives. We feel jealousy. And I was just staggered recently when someone confessed jealousy of me. And I couldn't believe it. It was someone that I couldn't possibly think like, I couldn't think of anything in their life. I couldn't think of anything in their life that they could possibly feel they were lacking. But they felt crippled with jealousy by me. I wonder if that's an emotion some of us feel. We feel resentment of other people's success. We find it easy to criticize. We're very liberal with our criticism. We blame others. We feel an intimidation and ultimately, sadly, self-hatred. And in turn, these emotions will lead to external behaviors and actions. We gossip to undermine others, to step away from our own reality and who we are, but we can talk about other people's failings. We feel isolation. I wonder if any of you have never gone, if you sort of opted out of a party. You've been invited to a party at someone's house and you've responded that you're busy or you can't come. But actually you wanted to go, but you felt you wouldn't be enough. You felt that if you went, you wouldn't be funny enough, you wouldn't be cool. It'd be easy just to stay at home and watch Netflix. Well, we dominate. The only way we can deal with this situation is to put our print on a room because we're so afraid of who we are, that we're not enough, We have domination as an option, as competition. We manipulate to get what we want. And sadly, ultimately, self-hatred leads to self-harm. Eating disorders and self-harm is a way to punish ourselves for who we think we should be when we think we're not enough. This ultimately results in a limited you. You're not living what God has given you. The ground that you've been called to stand on, the relationships that he's given you, the gifts, the opportunities, the destiny, you're limited. And you limit others. You limit others partly by undermining them, but partly because the picture of the church in the Bible we have is of mutual dependence and every part playing. And if you don't play your part, we end up with a limited church. We're not who we are because individuals step away from who they are. Ultimately, it means that we're together as a people. We're not who we should be. For me, it's been a thing all my life, probably. Probably for all of us. This is a sort of universal human thing. But in my own life, I really struggled with friendships until I was about sort of 15. I've got loads of friends now, so it's fine. But at the time, I didn't feel like I fitted, partly because my dad was a vicar, which meant that essentially strange things happen in our house. So not everyone's house had like 50 Bibles in the front room. And all these weird things would happen. So I always just felt slightly different. And so I was like, isolation, that would be a big thing for me. I would be invited to do things, but I'd be so afraid. Like, I remember once being invited to go to Beavers, and I didn't know how to ride a bike, and everyone else did. And the way I dealt with it was just like, I'm not going to tell anyone. I'm just going to opt out of this whole thing, because I'm too afraid to show any weakness or anything that I'm not. So it was easier for me just to isolate into my own world than to have friends. Like I said, I've got loads of friends now, so it's fine. But anyway, and then like with Lulu, when we were going out, it was so hard for us to make a decision about whether to be married. It actually took years and years and years. And actually at our wedding, a lot of our friends and family, I think, let out an audible sigh of relief. But actually in that long period, several years, where lots of our friends met, fell in love and got married, and we were still there kind of like trying to figure out what to do. And the most unhelpful thing of all was to compare our relationship to others. That actually crippled. That didn't help me make a decision about what I thought. It didn't help us to come to anywhere healthy. And it'd be the same now with things like babies. We look around and people having babies. And actually, if I analyze like, what do they earn? What kind of house they have? Can they do the washing up well? And are we going to be? That's not going to help. We've got to walk like you're our own path. And actually, for me, the reason why I'm preaching this message is last year, as we started to begin planting a church. When I thought, I should really have this nailed by now, I'm like a professional Christian, like planting church, I'm kind of a big deal, like I don't really have an issue with comparison at all. I felt hit so hard with the vulnerability of actually, we're going to go for this, we're going to do this. And it was my reference group. I wasn't like intimidated by anyone who's like really established. It was just people in my kind of bracket, maybe a year or two ahead. And I look at things that were going on around the country. I look at friends of mine starting to plant churches. I just feel crippled by fear that I won't be able to do that. When my time comes, actually, I won't be enough. I'll be too impatient. I'll be too inconsistent. I'm not gifted enough. I'm not talented enough. I won't be able to do it. And sad to admit, but true, I would look at other things working and I would find problem with its methodology. They're doing it all wrong. Too many lights, not enough lights, whatever the issue was. It was a way really of me to sort of not feel what was deep down inside, which is, can you actually do this? Has God actually called you this? Do you actually believe that God is good? He doesn't lie and he loves you and he's made you to do it. And so I started to journey on this myself. And I think the reality is we've probably all got our own stories. Those are my stories, but we've all got our own things. This is a universal thing. But we each have to face sort of one essential issue to come back to the beach. Can we hold the gaze of Jesus long enough for him to speak to us? Can we hold the gaze of Jesus long enough that whoever we've put in the mirror disappears? See, this is an incredible moment when Jesus speaks to Peter. This isn't just, it's like we hear the stories of the Bible and we take them for granted, but you read about Stephen Hawking dying this week, the physicist. Well, there's some beautiful obituaries about his life. And my favorite line was in the obituary in the New Yorker that said, he roamed the cosmos from a wheelchair. An incredible picture of a journey that a man confined to a wheelchair makes in his mind to explore theoretically the outer limits of the cosmos. But the journey that Jesus makes to Peter is even greater. This is God. This is the exterior of the cosmos with a face who's come to Peter to speak into his pain and his reality. This is the great outside, the other thing, that whatever is beyond what we know has come and spoken tenderly to a man full of boldness, but a man full of failure. And he is speaking courage and destiny and life. This is an amazing thing. If you haven't heard this before, that's what Christianity is about. That God is fully God. Jesus is fully God and he's fully human. He's up in your grill. He's face to face. He's speaking freedom and he's speaking life. He's not an abstract idea, but he's a person who loves you. And that's really how we get over comparison. We have to come face to face with Jesus. We stand in front of the mirror and we first acknowledge that whoever we put on is wrong. We notice that actually it's us in front of the mirror. We take responsibility for our lives. And then you use faith. And faith basically means trust. It's like leaning your life on something. And you use faith to think about Jesus and think about the faith of Jesus, the face of Jesus. So you read the scriptures. You think of the encouragement of your friends. You think of the prophecies on your life. Or you rise faith and you imagine Jesus' face. Literally, do this in front of your mirror. Imagine Jesus' face. So you're no longer even looking at yourself. You've got Jesus right in front of you. And the word that Jesus says over each person in this room, the word that he says over you today is that you're beloved. And that was the thing that Peter missed, that John knew. You would have picked up in the passage I read earlier. That John describes himself in his own book as the disciple that Jesus loved. The disciple who laid his head on Jesus' chest in intimacy. The disciple that Jesus loved. Beloved, beloved child. That's what Jesus says. If you want to deal with comparison, imagine the face of Jesus, obscuring your own, and receive fully in your heart, beloved, and then allow yourself to see again your own face. But this time, with the word beloved written large over it. In fact, I actually did this last year when I was like right in the middle of sort of this struggle. Got out a Sharpie, didn't think it through necessarily, wrote beloved. It hasn't fully gone, but it now kind of says like beloved, like that. It's a sort of. Anyway, you could do it. Maybe not if you share a house, that would be weird. But you could still do it, even so. But this is actually what it means to deal with comparison. To receive Jesus saying over you, your beloved. And from that place, that's the only appropriate place to glimpse someone else walking in the background in the mirror. And to see them also as beloved. And then, KXC, then we become the community of the beloved. Then rather than criticize, we can celebrate other people's success. Rather than retreat in fear, we can bring fully who we are. Comparison becomes a gift. Because when you look at someone else, all you do is cheer them on. When someone has done something well, it's inspiration for you. We need one another. Comparison becomes redeemed by the ability to share in the fact that we are all beloved. The ear, the nose, the mouth, every part of the body of Christ pulling together. Even the feet. The feet smell, but they've got to walk places, so let them be smelly. Every part pulling together. The community of the beloved, KXC. That's what you are invited to join. That's what you're invited to be about tonight. To reject comparison, reject the false faces that you've seen. And to see your own anew afresh with the words of Jesus over that you are beloved. So I wonder if you're up for it. I wonder if you want to step into this tonight. Step into the reality of Jesus' love. The reality that in all the ups and downs, like Peter, he loved you throughout. He loved you when you were this high. He'll love you when you're old and when you're going out to be taken out. Whatever happens when you're old. Like when you're old, basically. He'll love you throughout. He loves you. I wonder if you need to hear this tonight, that actually, if you've disqualified yourself, if I've rubbed a nerve, if you've felt uncomfortable when I've talked about some of these things, maybe you want to believe that God could deal with that. Maybe ultimately, this is a battle over God's goodness, whether he really is good and he really does love you.